What boy would not be an Indian for a while when he thinks of the freest life in the world? This life was mine. Every day there was a real hunt. There was real game. Occasionally there was a medicine dance away off in the woods where no one could disturb us, in which the boys impersonated their elders, Brave Bull, Standing Elk, High Hawk, Medicine Bear, and the rest. They painted and imitated their fathers and grandfathers to the minutest detail, and accurately too, because they had seen the real thing all their lives. We were not only good mimics, but we were close students of nature. We studied the habits of animals just as you study your books. We watched the men of our people and represented them in our play, then learned to emulate them in our lives. No people have a better use of their five senses than the children of the wilderness. We could smell as well as hear and see. We could feel and taste as well as we could see and hear. Nowhere has the memory been more fully developed than in the wildlife, and I can still see wherein I owe much to my early training. Of course, I myself do not remember when I first saw the day, but my brothers have often recalled the event with much mirth, for it was a custom of the Sioux that when a boy was born, his brother must plunge into the water or roll in the snow naked if it was winter time, and if he was not big enough to do either of these himself, water was thrown on him. If the newborn had a sister, she must be immersed. The idea was that the warrior had come to camp and the other children must display some act of hardihood. I was so unfortunate as to be the youngest of five children who, soon after I was born, were left motherless. I had to bear the humiliating name Hakada, meaning the pitiful last, until I should earn a more dignified and appropriate name. I was regarded as little more than a plaything by the rest of the children. My mother, who was known as the handsomest woman of all the Spirit Lake and Leaf Dweller Sioux, was dangerously ill, and one of the medicine men who attended her said, "Another medicine man has come into existence, but the mother must die. Therefore, let him bear the name Mysterious Medicine." But one of the bystanders hastily interfered, saying that an uncle of the child already bore that name, so for the time I was only Hakada. My beautiful mother, sometimes called the demigoddess of the Sioux, who tradition says had every feature of a Caucasian descent, with the exception of her luxuriant black hair and deep black eyes, held me tightly to her bosom upon her deathbed, while she whispered a few words to her mother-in-law. She said, "I give you this boy of your own. I cannot trust my own mother with him. She will neglect him, and he will surely die." The woman to whom these words were spoken was below the average in stature, remarkably active for her age. She was then fully 60, and possessed of as much goodness as intelligence. My mother's judgment concerning her own mother was well founded, for soon after her death that old lady appeared and declared that Hakada was too young to live without a mother. She offered to keep me until I died, and then she would put me in my mother's grave. Of course, my other grandmother denounced the suggestion as a very wicked one and refused to give me up. The babe was done up, as usual, in a movable cradle made from an oak board 2.5 feet long and one end and 1.5 feet wide. On one side of it was nailed with brass-headed tacks the richly embroidered sack, which was open in front and laced up and down with buckskin strings. Over the arms of the infant was a wooden bow, the ends of which were firmly attached to the board, so that if the cradle should fall, the child's head and face would be protected. On this bow were hung curious playthings, strings of artistically carved bones and hoofs of deer, which rattled when the little hands moved them. In this upright cradle I lived, played and slept the greater part of the time during the first few months of life. Whenever I was made to lean against a lodge pole or was suspended from a bough of a tree, while my grandmother cut wood, or whether I was carried on her back or conveniently balanced by another child in a similar cradle hung on the opposite side of a pony, I was still in my oaken bed. This grandmother, who had already lived through 60 years of hardships, was a wonder to the young maidens of the tribe. She showed no less enthusiasm over Hakoda than she had done when she held her firstborn, the boy's father, in her arms. Every little attention that is due to a loved child she performed with much skill and devotion. She made all my scanty garments and my tiny moccasins with a great deal of taste. It is said by all that I could not have had more attention had my mother been living. Uncheedah, the grandmother, was a great singer. Sometimes when Hakoda wakened too early in the morning, she would sing to him something like the following lullaby. Sleep, sleep, my boy. The Chippewas are far away, far away. Sleep, sleep, my boy. Prepare to meet the foe by day, the foe by day. The cowards will not dare to fight till morning break, till morning break. Sleep, sleep, my child, while still 'tis night. Then bravely wake, then bravely wake. The Dakota women were wont to cut and bring their fuel from the woods, and in fact to perform most of the drudgery of the camp. This of necessity fell to their lot, because the men must follow the game during the day. Very often my grandmother carried me with her on these excursions, and while she worked it was her habit to suspend me from a wild grapevine or a springy bough, so that the least breeze would swing the cradle to and fro. She has told me that when I had grown old enough to take notice, I was apparently capable of holding extended conversations in an unknown dialect with birds and red squirrels. Once I fell asleep in my cradle, suspended 5 or 6 feet from the ground, while Uncheedah was some distance away gathering birch bark for a canoe. A squirrel had found it convenient to come up upon the bow of my cradle and nibble his hickory nut until he awoke me by dropping the crumbs of his meal. My disapproval of this of his intrusion was so decided that he had to take a sudden and quick flight to another bough, and from there he began to pour out his wrath upon me while I continued my objections to his presence so audibly that Uncheedah soon came to my rescue and compelled the bold intruder to go away. It was a common thing for birds to alight on my cradle in the woods. My food was at first a troublesome question for my kind foster mother. She cooked some wild rice and strained it and mixed it with broth made from choice venison. She also pounded dried venison almost to a flour, kept it in a water till the nourishing juices were extracted, then mixed it with some pounded maize, which was browned before pounding. This soup of wild rice, pounded venison and maize was my mainstay, but soon my teeth came, much earlier than the white children usually cut theirs, and when my good nurse gave me a little more varied food, and I did all my own grinding. After I left my cradle, I almost walked away from it, she told me. She then began calling my attention to natural objects. Whenever I heard the song of a bird, she would tell me what bird it came from, something after this fashion. Hakoda, listen to Shikoda, the robin, calling his mate. He says he has just found something good to eat. Or listen to Upenchka, the thrush. He is singing for his little wife. He will sing his best. When in the evening the whippoorwill started his song with vim, no further than a stone's throw from our tent in the woods, she would say to me, "Hush, it may be an Obaje scout." Again, when I waked at midnight, she would say, "Do not cry. Hinakaga, the owl, is watching you from the treetop." I usually covered up my head, for I had perfect faith in my grandmother's admonitions, and she had given me a dreadful idea of this bird. It was one of her legends that the little boy was once standing out just outside of the teepee tent, crying vigorously for his mother, when Hinakaga swooped down in the darkness and carried the poor little fellow up into the trees. It was well known that the hoot of an owl was commonly imitated by Indian scouts when on the warpath. There had been dreadful massacres immediately following this call. Therefore, it was deemed wise to impress the sound early upon the mind of the child. Indian children were trained so that they hardly ever cried much in the night. This was very expedient and necessary in their exposed life. In my infancy, it was my grandmother's custom to put me to sleep, as she said, with the birds, and to waken me with them until it became a habit. She did this with an object in view. An Indian must always rise early. In the first place, as a hunter, he finds his game best at daybreak. Secondly, other tribes, when on the warpath, usually make their attack very early in the morning. Even when our people are moving about leisurely, we like to rise before daybreak in order to travel when the air is cool and unobserved, perchance, by our enemies. As a child, it was instilled into me to be silent and reticent. This was one of the most important traits to form in the character of the Indian. As a hunter and warrior, it was considered absolutely necessary to him and was thought to lay the foundations of patience and self-control. There are times when boisterous mirth is indulged in by our people, but the rule is gravity and decorum. After all, my babyhood was full of interest and the beginnings of life's realities. The spirit of daring was already whispered into my ears. The value of the eagle feather was worn by the warrior had caught my eye. One day, when I was left alone at scarcely 2 years of age, I took my uncle's war bonnet and plucked out all its eagle feathers to decorate my dog and myself. So soon the life that was about me had made its impress, and already I desired intensely to comply with all of its demands.